From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is again claiming presidential harassment now that special counsel Robert Mueller has agreed to testify in public before the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees next month. Meanwhile, tonight is the first of a two-part debate among Democratic presidential contenders.
So let's take it all in with our midweek political strategist. We're going to start with Alice Stewart, the Republican. She's in Washington. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin, Jeremy. Great to be here.
So this big headline last night, special counsel Robert Mueller will testify in public before the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committee's two hearings on July 17th. This is after he received subpoenas to testify. But here's President Trump on Fox Business.
I have been attacked for 2.5 years with a phony, dishonest, crooked group of people in intelligence agencies and beyond that have been doing nothing but attacking your president.
That's right. I know.
So, Alice, that's what the president does best, and Fox agreeing with him right there, that's right. This is to be expected of this president. But would you advise, is this the best course of action? What if Democrats like Adam Schiff do as promised and say, why isn't a meeting between President Trump or then-candidate Trump's son and a Russian operative to take information about Hillary Clinton in Trump Tower, why isn't that conspiracy? I mean, this could not go well for the president.
It can go both ways. I anticipate we're going to have two different strategies. We will have Adam Schiff and the Democrats do their best to try and uncover more information than we originally got out of the report and more insight and more of the impressions that Mueller had in his investigation as to the extent or the level of coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians and whether or not there is more evidence that needs to be looked into with regard to the transferring of information. But at the end of the day, the report was rather conclusive in terms of no conspiracy, no collusion, no coordination, and that is really the ultimate takeaway. What's going to be the issue, and I think highlight of this, is what the Republicans are going to do. They're going to open up an entire new can of questions with regard to the origins of this investigation, specifically the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA warrants. How did these begin? Why did certain people become part of this investigation? And they will do exactly as President Trump wants them to do, question the origins of this investigation from the very beginning, but as opposed to the outcome.
Alice, that is kind of what their strategy was when Michael Cohen, the president's former fixer and lawyer, testified for many hours on Capitol Hill. And yet there were a lot of headlines that came out of that testimony that did drive the news coverage for many, many days because of what the Democrats were asking Cohen. Do you think that this testimony by Mueller, because people won't be able to say, you know, he's a crook and you can't believe anything he says, is it going to be different?
Well, look at who we're talking about. We're talking about testimony from Michael Cohen versus testimony from Mueller. Two different people, two different sources of information, and certainly Mueller will be complete with his answers. I believe he will be much more forthcoming with information to address these questions. Clearly, Michael Cohen reserved a lot of information and kept certain things in confidence and did not disclose some information. But in the end, in my view, the origin of this investigation will go under the spotlight and will face further scrutiny. But you cannot deny if there was this meeting and if there are questions about it. I've always said the origin for this investigation and the need and desire to question this and investigate this was always there. But the report is in. The results have been handed down. In my view, it's time to move on.
Well, Alice, we have a bit of a confession to make here. We are waiting for Bill Press, who's your partner sometimes on these roundtables. He's the Democratic strategist who we have several colleagues out searching the streets for him. He's apparently in his car lost. Bill, if you've got a phone number,
we're trying to have a fair and balanced segment here, but
And we're hoping
just
that's
got
not
the Republican strategist, which is fine.
We're hoping that's not a metaphor for the Democrat.
Right,
exactly.
Right,
I think he's somewhere in Boston eating some lobster, enjoying himself, and will join us when he can.
Well, the point is that we do want to talk about the debates tonight. So you're on, Alice. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Well, let's ask about that. There are going to be 10 candidates on the stage tonight. Not the front runners right now, at least according to the polls, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, but many of the others. Elizabeth Warren will be on the stage, and she has been in Florida ahead of the debate, visiting an immigration detention center in Homestead to call attention to what's been going on at the border. She called for more aid to Latin American countries where violence and poverty are fueling migration. Let's listen.
Help make it work for people to be able to stay, but treat the people who come here with the dignity and kindness that marks the United States of America.
Alice, Warren is leading in the polls among the candidates that she will share the stage with tonight. What are you looking for in tonight's debate? And keep it quick, because Bill Press has walked in. We'll let him respond afterwards.
I'm glad you made it, Bill. Look, this will be a big night for all of them. Elizabeth Warren certainly will be in the spotlight. She has a great opportunity to really distinguish herself and set herself ahead of the pack. But I've worked for the candidates that are on the low end of the polling numbers on a huge debate stage the last three presidential cycles. These are opportunities for the lesser-known candidates to have a breakout moment, have that time in the spotlight, say that quote or that comment, that takeaway line that wins over some voters. So this is a key night, not just for Warren, but for everyone who will be up on that stage to really distinguish themselves tonight.
So Bill Press, I'm going to do the list. How are you, breathless?
No, I feel good and sorry to be late.
And you've done a tour. Look, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Secretary Julian Castro, Mayor Bill de Blasio, Representative John Delaney, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Governor Jay Inslee, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Representative Beto O'Rourke, Representative Tim Ryan, Senator Elizabeth Warren. Who can break out?
I think it's fair. First of all, it was Elizabeth Warren's night. There's no doubt about it. She drew the lucky straw, if you will, and she has a chance to really shine, to put her plans and ideas forth. I know that's what she wants to do. I think it's very important for her to come across as likable and as somebody that people can understand and identify with. At the same time, for everybody, it really is the first time that they've been seen by a national audience, even for Elizabeth Warren. Most people don't know these candidates at all. So the others have an opportunity, as Alice said, for a breakthrough moment. And I think it's particularly important tonight for Cory Booker, for Amy Klobuchar, and for Julian Castro, because they've the ones who've been sort of in second tier. And if they're ever going to break through, this is their chance. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would point out, and again, they break through with a good idea, with a clever phrase, I think keeping it positive, I would hope. The other thing I'd point out is there's a certain disadvantage here, because if they have a moment, if they have a breakthrough moment, it's only going to last 24 hours because the next debate's tomorrow night.
It's going to be tomorrow night.
And then we'll be talking about Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and
Do you think a lot of people will be watching this debate? You say it's their first opportunity to speak to a national audience. Do you think a lot of people that don't ordinarily pay attention to politics will be watching this debate?
I believe so. I believe there's been so much attention to this primary. And by the way, I must say, I find the number of candidates, the quality of candidates to be very exciting. I think it speaks to the vitality and the energy on the Democratic Party. And I think that's felt nationwide. So there's so much curiosity about this crowd that I think both nights will get a good number. We'll see, but I believe so.
Well, Alice, where do you think the pitfalls are? I mean, you have, you know, Cory Booker, who has recently criticized Joe Biden. You have a division on healthcare, a division on what to do about the border. What will you be looking for?
I'll be looking for them to distinguish themselves on the policies and making themselves very personable to those who are watching. So many of them are very similar on the issues and where they stand on policy. Finding that one key area, whether it is just a small tweak from the others, showing the contrast you have is critical, and being personable and likable. And whether or not many people watch tonight, that will be a question. It is the coverage you have over the next 24 hours and until the next debate next month that will be critical. So it's important to have a good night out of the gate tonight, but have that key soundbite, have that key interaction, have that good moment that will not just shine tonight, but be part of the headlines tomorrow and in weeks to come.
Bill, it seems like almost every week leading up to at least a few weeks ago, there was a new candidate entering the race. Do you think we're now getting get to the point where even maybe very soon after these debates, some of them drop out? Or will they wait?
I hope so. I saw over the weekend, I couldn't believe it, or a couple of days ago, that Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania jumped
in. Is he running too?
Yeah,
oh,
right.
Okay.
I mean, hello, right. No, we have enough candidates right now. And I do think that this is the beginning of the winnowing process, meaning after this first debate, certainly after the second debate, I think the numbers will shrink from 23 down to maybe a dozen. Wow. And then more will drop out after the Iowa caucuses.
Well, and Allison, as a Republican, you know there's a cautionary tale here. Everybody, name the 2016 Republican presidential candidates. And we were thinking of Carly Fiorina the other. I mean, you just don't hear of some of them. And so there's a caution there that you have to grab that brass ring now or you're gone.
Right. And she did. She was our vice presidential candidate on the Cruz campaign. She grabbed that ring and she ran with it. She set herself apart. She made a great name for herself. And that is the key for all of those folks on the stage to use this opportunity. I don't want anyone else to jump in, but I do think all these people
at this point
need to stay in, hold on until there's absolutely no gas left in the tank. I still think they have a long way to go.
A lot at stake tonight.
Republican strategist Alice Stewart, Bill Press, Democratic strategist, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. EmberWave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, own your temperature.
This year, Pride Month ends with what might be the largest Pride event in history. The World Pride Parade will take place in New York for the first time this year, making what is already one of the largest Pride events in the world, New York City's Pride Parade, even bigger. New York's parade this Sunday is organized by the nonprofit Heritage of Pride. The event has corporate sponsors, including Target, JetBlue, TD Bank. And some are arguing that these sponsorships allow corporations to engage in so-called pinkwashing, glossing over some of their not-so-queer-friendly actions. And they say that as a result, Pride events have lost the activist feel of the Stonewall riots also 50 years ago. The Reclaim Pride Coalition is here to change that. They're organizing the Queer Liberation March on the very same day in New York. There will be no corporate floats or police officers. And they say they're marching in solidarity with other oppressed groups to demand social and economic justice worldwide. Norman Siegel is the attorney for the Reclaim Pride Coalition, former executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Norman, welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin.
And let's talk a little bit about this, because this is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. This is when people at a gay bar, the Stonewall in New York, fought back for the first time after yet another police raid on the bar. The New York City Pride Parade people say that they are commemorating the Stonewall riots. The Reclaim Pride Coalition is making some claim there as well. What's the connection?
Well, the June 69 Stonewall uprising and the first marchers were about freedom to be who you are and to take pride in that. The Reclaim Pride Coalition that I represent wants to make sure that Stonewall 50 lives up to the spirit of what happened in the streets of New York City 50 years ago. So we're going to march again. We're going to go through the historic route going up 6th Avenue into Central Park. And from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock, we're going to have a First Amendment political rally. And we're going to talk to the issues that are still present today, the homophobia, the stereotyping, in a very political manner.
Well, but you know, a lot of people are arguing that this corporate support of Pride is a sign of success and progress. 379 companies urged the Supreme Court to support same-sex marriage in 2015. These are companies openly stating with their floats and their corporate sponsorship that they're supporting the gay community. The police are wearing their own, you know, vests indicating that they're, in fact, a member of the community. Isn't that a good thing?
It's one step in a larger picture. But my clients believe that this is not the time, especially on the 50th anniversary when the world will be watching, to have an effect a Mardi Gras. It's not the time to be partying out in the streets. but to focus on the continuing struggles and the challenges that we face. My clients believe that we need to continue the fight for civil rights so that one day an individual's sexual orientation will be no longer a barrier to full and true equality. We haven't gotten there yet. And so when you're a member of the trans community and the police still stereotype those folks and they arrest them and they harass them, that's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. When people still are being discriminated based on their sexual orientation, when people walking down the street, men holding each other's hands, women holding each other's hands, and people begin to stare at them and look at them like there's something unusual, we're still not in the position of full and true equality. So we need to continue to make that point. You know, I worked in the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s, and that struggle continued. And even though we made progress, we still had to continue. We're continuing today on the issues of racism. The same thing with regard to the LGBT community.
Well, and reading in Out magazine, that the thinking is, you know, no uniform cops in our parade, no corporate floats. But what about, you know, people just joining in? Can anybody just join in?
Yes. Our folks were very insistent when I negotiated for the right to march on 6th Avenue in New York City that we don't have the middle barriers out on the sidewalk. So as we're marching up 6th Avenue and people are watching, we could say to them, join us. Come on in. Be part of this movement. Even if you're not a member of the LGBT community, we need supporters. We need allies. Come on in. That's the kind of spirit that we want. And with regard to the corporate presence, the feeling is that the corporations changed the tone, and therefore the Reclaim Pride people took the position that they don't want corporate floats. This is not a Mardi Gras. This is a political First Amendment peaceful activity.
So, Norman Siegel, we understand you're working for the ACLU in the South when the Stonewall Inn riots happened. Do you remember that impact?
Oh, yes. The Stonewall uprising and those first marches were about people expressing their freedom to who they were and to take pride in that. And it has been and continues to be a struggle and a challenge to achieve true and full equality. Let's hope that June 30th, 2019 is a day that will be remembered as continuing and expanding the liberation and pride that filled the streets of New York City 50 years ago.
Norman Siegel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, Norman Siegel is attorney for the Reclaim Pride Coalition.
Well, American Airlines has announced it is retiring the last of its McDonnell Douglas MD-80 airplanes. The twin-engined, single-aisle airplane was the workhorse of American's regional fleet from the 1980s until recently. It's easily recognizable by its rear-mounted engines, its so-called eyebrow windows in the cockpit as well, designed so that pilots could see the stars for navigation. The final flights in early September will be a milestone for a plane that pilots called the Mad Dog. Joining us now to talk about it is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the Mad Dog, tell us a little bit about the history of this plane. When was it introduced and why?
Yeah, the Mad Dog, the MD, right, to play on
oh,
that.
Oh, right, of course.
Started life as the DC-9 back in the mid-60s. DC stood for Douglas Corporation. Back then, airlines wanted something more efficient than what was out there. Most airplanes back then had three or four engines, and it was revolutionary back then to be able to carry a plane load of passengers with just two engines. And so, yeah, this was one of the first planes out there doing that. The 737 followed a little while later, sort of forced Boeing to do that, to compete. Later became the MD when a merger led to McDonnell Douglas.
McDonnell Douglas merged with Boeing in 1997 as well, and production of this plane ended shortly thereafter. But a lot of us have flown in the MD-80. Yeah. What are the characteristics that make it stand out?
Yeah, you mentioned those rear-mounted engines. So that's something that even just kind of casual observers who might not be able to tell the difference, like you and I can, between a 737 and an A320, let's say, almost anybody, you know, if you see sort of that mid-sized airplane that holds about 150 people, if the engines are way there on the back, It's an MD-80.
Well, and also you hear them more, right? When you're taking off, you hear those engines.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jeremy, you know, I remember sitting on a flight. It was Continental, back before Continental merged with United, when they still had MD-80s, sitting next to a mechanic for the airline back something like 15 years ago. And the two of us together, as we were taking off, we were just, there's nothing like it. It feels more like a rocket than an airplane. And it also, something else that passengers tend to like, doesn't have very many middle seats because in economy, it's 2x3 seating rather than 3x3. So more often than not, if there's somebody in the middle seat, it's maybe somebody you're traveling with.
So why is American retiring this jet?
Well, those same planes that started life as you know, revolutionary, best-in-class economics and all the rest of it, you know, we just mentioned they started life really in the mid-60s and have evolved since then, but not enough to where the economics are where airlines want them today. So American, earlier this decade, ordered several hundred new airplanes from Boeing and Airbus, 737s, various types of variants of the A320s. And so now that those planes have come in big numbers, after the summer peak here, right now, every plane's up in the air pressed into service because of, you know, the MAX grounding. But after demand sort of drops and we're into September, they're going to go ahead and retire those last MD-80s.
TWA, which American swallowed up many years ago, also used some of these planes too, right?
In fact, of the last 28 planes that American is flying right now, 27 of them, Jeremy, began life at TWA. Huh. There's actually just one plane, looked a little while ago. It's in the sky today, flying between Dallas and Cleveland and back and on to Raleigh-Durham, according to FlightAware. Just one, that plane that began life at American. And yeah, American inherited quite a few of them from TWA back when American bought TWA in the early part of this century.
So does this announcement from American mean the end of the MD-80 series over U.S. skies?
Not yet, because Delta has actually a couple hundred of these. If you count the larger version of the plane, Delta has MD-88s and MD-90s, and also what's called the Boeing 717, but was essentially the updated version of the MD-80. You mentioned that merger back in 97 led to that. So Delta has actually invested in refurbishing some of these planes, and it's going to be flying them for a while longer.
Why do you think that people, pilots, flight attendants, et cetera, are so sentimental about this plane?
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it's a lot of it is, well, again, those rear engines, just it feels different. And it you just feel a connection to an old era. You get on one of these airplanes and you think, and sometimes I'll kind of look up, you know, where did this plane start life and when? And you think about, you know, you picture people, good and bad, you picture people, you know, smoking in the back of the plane, you know, and all the rest of it, just all the things that have happened in that airplane over the decades. And so I think that's a large part of it. It's a connection to the past, but it's also a unique plane in ways that aren't even true of other older planes.
Seth Kaplan, here now, transportation analyst, remembering the MD-80. Thanks.
It can be difficult for Muslim women in this country to find clothing that's both stylish and modest, but some Muslim designers in St. Louis, Missouri, aren't waiting for the fashion industry. They put on a Muslim fashion show to showcase their own creations for women who are looking for clothing that fits their lifestyle. As St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan reports, the demand for more modest clothing is growing worldwide.
A model sweeps down the runway, dressed in an ankle-length gown the color of a robin's egg. Her dress features long flowing sleeves and a belt of gold coins. She's part of the Modest Muslim Women's Fashion Show, organized by the Council for American Islam Relations in Missouri.
I want to create clothes that make a woman feel like it's her wedding day whenever she feels like it.
St. Louis-based fashion designer Mojda Siddiqui designed many of the outfits for the show. She was born in Kabul, Afghanistan. Her family moved to the St. Louis suburbs almost 20 years ago. Siddiqui says she's loved fashion for as long as she can remember. But it wasn't until she visited an Afghani bazaar when she was a teenager that she first thought of making her own clothes.
I saw all the different fabrics and the different textures and the different colors, and there were so many. And I remember, like, waking up on the inside.
That was more than a decade ago. Now Siddiqui has racks of clothing that she's designed herself.
This is my closet. Welcome. This dress, look how beautiful this black dress is.
Many of the dresses have long flowing sleeves and high necks, designs that fit her personal and religious beliefs, while still allowing her to feel feminine. She says part of what inspired her to design her own clothes was the lack of options at stores in the U.S., something her friend Yusra Ali knows all too well.
I wore like giant stretched out old t-shirts and baggy clothes because every time I go to the mall, it was just really, really tight-fitted clothes. It was so hard to find anything that was decent for me to wear.
But that's changing, driven mostly by increasing demand. Globally, Muslim consumers spent more than $250 billion on clothing in 2017, according to the latest State of the Global Islamic Economy report. That number is expected to increase by about $100 billion in the next 4 years. Washington Post fashion critic Robin Gavan says high-end designers are starting to pay attention to these markets.
The areas of growth for the fashion industry, it's happening in places like the Middle East and Asia. You have to be able to create clothes that they want to wear, that they feel comfortable wearing.
More designers, she says, are incorporating modest styles that feel sophisticated and powerful. And that's something that many women are looking for, regardless of their religious beliefs, says Samer Albarsha, a Syrian-American fashion blogger.
I know a lot of Jewish friends, Orthodox Jewish friends, who have a certain dress code. There's a lot of Mormon Christian friends who also have their own dress codes. And there's also people that are not necessarily religious, but it's just a value that they like to instill because it reflects them in their personality.
Albarsha, who grew up in St. Louis, says the definition of modest is up for interpretation. For some women, it's a one-piece bathing suit. For others, it's an ankle-length dress and hijab. At the end of the day, she says it's about the freedom to choose. For Here and Now, I'm Shayla Farzan in St. Louis, Missouri.
And to see some of the clothing, click on Trying to Change at this story at hereandnow.org.
And it's summer, so we're plunging into bodies of water. And people like me are worrying. I worry. I was once caught in a riptide. What a nightmare. Earlier this month, a Massachusetts paddleboarder was swept out to sea by heavier-than-expected winds. But she used an Apple Watch to call 911. That call was forwarded to the harbor master, who deployed a boat who rescued the stranded paddler. In a minute, some of the technologies that might help us all in a crisis. But first, we've reached Swampscott, Massachusetts, harbor master William Waters. Yes, that is his name. Harbor Master Waters, was this a first, a call on an Apple Watch?
Yes, definitely a first for me.
Oh, boy. And so when you reached the paddleboarder, how relieved was she to have had this technology?
She was very relieved. She had been blown offshore, and she was quite tired from trying to paddle. But she was able to, use her technology to get a hold of 911. And when we showed up, she was pretty happy to see us, and very, very fortunate she had that device on.
Yeah, I bet you were happy she had it on too, because this could have ended badly.
Well, it could have, because without communication, there was really no boats on the water that day because of the high winds. So, she would have been blown off way offshore, yeah, further than she was. She was pretty lucky that day.
Well, look, as we're going to find out, these are expensive devices. I mean, not everyone,
yes,
can have one. But you've had some other rescues just, recently, right?
Yes, this past weekend, we the same situation. High winds blew a family of four off of a beach in Swampscott, and that was a 911 call. We were able to retrieve those four victims, and they were unharmed. And
they were in a kayak.
Yes, they were in kayaks and a paddleboard. A family of four, two young children, mm-hmm, and a husband and wife. And yesterday, two young adults were blown off Kings Beach in Swampscott on a flotation device. And fearing they were going to be blown out to sea, they tried to swim in, and they weren't very strong swimmers, and they had to be rescued.
So, look, first of all, inflatables, people are, they're not anchored, so be careful with those. But
correct.
What do you think about this notion of, you know, Apple Watches, a device where, you know, somebody, you know, if they can afford such a thing, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, obviously, what happened, it's a great tool, something I never thought about before, but, you know, I'm thinking of purchasing one myself because the technology is great. And, you know, anytime you're out on the ocean and you have an extra way to communicate with safety personnel, it's always a good thing.
Harbor Master Bill Waters, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that incident and other ones got us thinking about some of the new safety features of the newest Apple Watches. So we've brought in Lauren Good, senior writer and tech expert with Wired Magazine, who joins us from San Francisco. Lauren, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, I have to tell you, as someone who was caught in a riptide once, I'm going to get one of these things because it just sounds...
Yeah, that really is everybody's worst nightmare.
Yeah, and it just sounds, you know, so... marvelous, but I know there are some, you know, some cautions. So let's first talk through the features. The 911 feature, we've seen a few reports. We'll talk about how people are using it, but how does it work?
So this is something that Apple refers to as SOS, and it is built into the Apple Watch. There are two physical buttons on the side of the Apple Watch. One of them is known as the digital crown, and that's kind of how you get to all of your apps and scroll through things. And then there's this flat side button. And fortunately, I've never had to use this, but apparently if you hold down that side button for long enough, you can trigger this SOS feature, which ultimately calls 911 or the emergency service that is local to your area. Mm-hmm. So there are some caveats that come with this in terms of which Apple Watch you have to have in order for this to work without your phone nearby. But with the right combination of technology and with certain models of Apple Watch, you can use the watch to call emergency services.
Okay, so that's key. Make sure there's different models. So make sure, depending on what you want to use yours for, that it can, you know, be waterproof or it doesn't have to be, you know, right next to your phone or whatever the consideration is. So you want to do that. But you talk about this flat button on the side, and we're reading accounts of, you know, people putting their hand in their pocket and the next thing you know, they turn around and the EMTs are there. Because it called 911.
Yes, you can inadvertently press this flat side button on the side of your watch and trigger the SOS function. Now, there are some alerts put into place. So there's a countdown and there are sounds that let you know the call is about to be made. You can actually cancel the call. There's also a feature that automatically sends a text message to your emergency contacts once an SOS call has been placed. You can intercept those before the text messages are sent if you have the right settings in place. But it is a very real thing that some people are probably accidentally triggering this SOS.
So just the simple, and it's actually kind of miraculous when you think about it, but being able to call 911, is it a special data plan that you need on your phone, or is it just included in the watch? What is this?
My understanding is that the SOS emergency calling feature is offered on Apple Watch Series 1 and later, but it's going to work differently. So if you have one of the latest Apple Watches, which is Apple Watch Series 4 or Apple Watch Series 3, which came out, I guess, the fall prior to that, those have cellular service options built in. They have the eSIM that is required in order for you to actually activate a cell service. So in the case of this paddleboarder, even if you didn't have your phone on you, provided there was cellular service, you could make the call from your watch. Mm-hmm. Once you get into the earlier models of Apple Watches, you can still make the call, but you have to have your phone nearby because your phone ultimately is what would wirelessly connect to the watch and make the phone call. You would have to be near a known Wi-Fi network because the call would have to be made over Wi-Fi in the case of just using the watch. If the watch doesn't have GPS, it's not going to use GPS to locate you. It's going to use that known Wi-Fi network.
Okay. All things to consider. Let's move to another feature. This is one that will give off an alert if you've fallen. So just to the fact that something detects when you've fallen, how does it know that you haven't, you know, gone out into the yard to look at the stars? I've revealed too much. But you know, how does it know that you're not just laying down?
Many of these devices are using combinations of accelerometers and gyroscopes and different sensors that are able to track your movement. But it's not just having the ability to track your movement that really makes the difference with features like this. It's the algorithms that are built in order to process that information and say, okay, we've matched this occasion, this incident against another data set, and we have determined that this looks like a fall. Typically, there's some type of arm movement that's associated with those kinds of falls, and typically there might be some type of impact that's different from a normal sort of profile of falling. And so that's how they think they're able to identify it.
Well, we understand on the Apple Watch, the device will contact you to see if you're okay. So that is one thing that it will do, and you'll have an opportunity to say, no, I haven't fallen. If you don't respond within a minute, the fall detection feature automatically calls the emergency services and shares the location. So there's that. Automatically enabled for wearers 65 years and older, and then others have to activate it through an app.
That's correct. So what you're describing is actually the combination of the first feature we talked about, the SOS feature, and the fall detection.
Talk about the Apple Watch feature. It's an EKG feature. It's heart detection.
That's correct. And this is something that, once again, is limited only to Apple Watch Series 4. It was rolled out late last year. It's an app that takes EKG recordings. It's looking basically for patterns that could potentially suggest something like atrial fibrillation, which the CDC estimates affects a lot of people, somewhere between 2.7 and 6.1 million Americans. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that It will detect your heart patterns, and perhaps if you were someone who had an arrhythmia that had gone undetected for years and years and you just had no idea, it could potentially present some data to you that suggests, hey, you should really go to a doctor and get this looked at. But for the most part, I don't think this is something that's going to really be game-changing or life-changing for a lot of people. There have also been some concerns that perhaps with some type of quote-unquote over-screening that perhaps it could make people unnecessarily sort of paranoid. It could give too much insight into somebody's health. It certainly got a lot of headlines at the time that Apple announced it because it was an FDA-cleared, which is, by the way, different from FDA-approved, an FDA-cleared application, and it shows how serious Apple is about monitoring your health. But I don't think it's something that the average, the average Apple Watch user is necessarily going to run out and buy the Apple Watch Series 4 just because it has this.
That's Lauren Good, senior writer and tech expert with Wired magazine in San Francisco. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
So, do you have a story to tell about a wearable device? Is it life-saving? Or are you one of those who, taxed our already overwhelmed 911 system by putting your hand in your pocket and accidentally calling? Share at hereandnow.org.
If the United Kingdom does eventually leave the European Union in October, less than 1% of those left in the EU will have English as their official language. But our next guest argues that Brexit is the perfect time to make English the official language of the EU. Joining us now is Jeremy Cliff of The Economist. He's with us from Berlin. Jeremy, make your case. Why should English be the official EU language after Brexit when such a small percentage of people would have it as their first language?
I think there are two main reasons. First of all, Europe has always needed some sort of common language, and it's always struggled because the big languages of Europe have always been quite political. You know, you've had English, which was spoken by Britain, which is always sort of half in and half out of the European Union. You've had French, which was always a classic diplomatic language in Europe, and you've had German, which was bound up with insecurities about German power and German dominance of Europe. And finally, there is a big European language that is neutral in the European Union, and that's English after Brexit. Britain will leave the European Union, or might leave the European Union later this year. And after that, you'll have a very small proportion of the European population that will actually speak English as a first language. You know, Ireland and Malta have English as a first language, mm-hmm. but they are less than 1% of the total population of the European Union. And so finally, there will be a common language that doesn't belong to a particular European Union member state. And not only that, it's a language that is already in some ways quite dominant. So, you know, 80% of the European Commission's documents are already written in their first language in English and translated into other languages. And then the second reason is that Europe is gradually becoming more politically integrated. You know, you see it with debates about immigration, debates about the environment, debates about the state of the European Union. slowly, the 28, soon to be 27 members of the European Union are becoming more like one political space. And I think that is a good case for one political language.
So why not French? The French would say, well, you know, if we're going to have one, let's make it French.
It's a fair argument. French is the classic diplomatic language in Europe. But at the same time, English is much, much more widely spoken. You know, a vast majority of European school children are learning English at some stage or another by the age of 12 or 13, which is not true of French. English is much more widely spoken in the Central European countries, so the countries that joined the European Union in 2004. French is not very commonly spoken, for example, in countries like Poland or the Czech Republic or Romania, whereas English is a commonly learned language there.
Everybody knows a little bit of English, basically, around
Europe.
That's
true. That's true. And actually, the language skills are getting better and better in every country. You know, it's becoming more and more common for, you know, thanks to EU projects like the Erasmus University Exchange, European students to travel from one country to another, but they do so in English. You know, you can have, for example, a German studying in Barcelona, learning, you know, studying under a, I don't know, Italian professor, and they'll do that all in English. Mm-hmm. You know, English is now the language of common exchange in Europe.
Well, and right now, the official language of Europe is actually 24 different languages, and they have to translate every official document, right, into all of the different languages.
Not everything. There is a slight preference towards English, French, and German. Those are considered because they are the official languages of the European Commission, which is the sort of, if you were the European White House, so it's a kind of European executive. But yes, everything that goes through the executive, the legislature, or everything that goes through the European Council, which is a bit like our Senate, gets translated into all of the languages of the Union. And I'm all for that. You know, I'm not pushing against European linguistic diversity here. But at the same time, I think there is something valuable about having a single language in which to exchange, in which to debate, in which to talk about different ideas. And I think, you know, you see that with even the United States. You know, the US never had an official right. language, but and took in people from all different parts of the world. And yet you guys, you know, you settled organically on English, and that's been a great strength because you can have a single political discussion. And I think that Europe probably needs to come to that point soon. Well, and actually Brexit makes that easier.
Well, do you think that Europe will come to that point soon? Do you think that they'll actually decide we're going to make one language the official language of Europe?
Well, obviously, I'd love it if they just read my column and immediately decided that that was the best course of action. In practice, I think it will take a bit longer. I think Europe's on a journey. I can imagine, for example, the European Commission deciding to sort of start scaling down some of the translation, maybe put more of those resources into actually supporting language learning, supporting the learning of the English language in countries where those skills are not so good in the European Union, kind of gradually shifting Europe towards that position. But it's going to take a long time. You know, you look at just the generational difference between, for example, people of my, you know, my grandparents' generation in Europe, whether they're Brits or French or German or Spanish or Polish, you know, who often have only one language, and people of my generation, I'm 31, who quite typically in Europe speak one or two or three languages. So I think you're kind of moving to a more multilingual Europe. And I think with that comes a greater communality of English. So I would think this as a kind of more long-term project.
Okay, finally, let me just ask you a really easy question before you go, which is Britain going to Brexit on October 31st?
No. I think that everyone says that it's going to happen, but we've heard that time and time again. You know, Britain will Brexit on the day it makes up its mind, and that's going to take a while yet.
That's Jeremy Cliff of The Economist. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Just an easy question.
I was going to say, is that an easy question?
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.